Hey, this is Richard Deitch. Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media about their work and their process. This week, special treat, author James Andrew Miller, who's a friend. You know him not only from this podcast, but his work chronicling ESPN, including the New York Times bestseller. These guys have all the fun. Jim's latest book is on CAA Powerhouse. Go check that out. If you have not seen that yet, he's also the author of Live from New York, The Oral History of Saturday Night Live, an amazing book. As part of this podcast, though, very heavy sports media talk, we discuss Mike Greenberg's new contract, reported by Jim in The Hollywood Reporter, and what that means for Greenberg and what that means for the larger ESPN ecosystem.
You got to think in the back of your mind about SportsCenter, and is there going to be some sort of role for Mike Greenberg with SportsCenter? Maybe, maybe not, but that is a franchise that is on life support.
We also get into many more things about ESPN, the future of SportsCenter, where Jim thinks Fox Sports 1 stands right now, and also a long conversation about Saturday Night Live and their political humor, how the win of Donald Trump impacts that show. And I asked him something I've really been wanting to ask him, what he thought the message was and what it meant for Kate McKinnon to do the Hallelujah song after the election result.
That moment was one of those moments where they just decided to go to a place. Now, I don't think that there are a lot of people at the show who think that it was as like politically pointed as it was.
All that and much more on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. Let's go to our guest, James Andrew Miller. All right, as promised, in studio, very rare for the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, in studio guest, the acclaimed author James Andrew Miller. You know his ESPN book, Those Guys Have All the Fun. His latest book is Powerhouse, which is the history of CAA, Creative Artists Agency. Pretty remarkable story and a really engaging read. He's also the author of the Saturday Night Live oral history. I think that's
Live from New York.
Live from New York. We'll get into a little bit about Saturday Night Live because it's really fascinating in the Trump era. And what else do I need to promote for you before we start this conversation? Anything?
That's good. I'm fine.
All right. You've come a long way for this podcast, at least 100 miles, and we appreciate it. All right. James Andrew Miller is here in studio. Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Let us start with this. It's so weird to have you in studio. We're trying to make it organic, but yet I know you for so long.
I wanted to throw him off his game
from the start. We'll try. You reported in The Hollywood Reporter last week. Am I right about this? Okay, story. You're doing a piece on sort of what is going to happen with the agencies in 2017. You know, you just did this tome on CAA. You're obviously incredibly plugged in to that world. And in the middle of the story, and now obviously this sort of certainly impacts my world, you report that ESPN's Mike Greenberg's new contract is in excess of $6.5 million annually, or north of $6.5 million, I think you said in the piece. So let's start off with this. How confident are you in those numbers?
I'm very confident. I mean, I haven't been contacted for a correction as of yet, and I wouldn't put it in. I've never had to retract a salary number that I put in. I wouldn't put it in unless I was confident.
One of the fascinating things, Jim, as both of us know, is when you print someone's salary in the sports media, it starts off a chain reaction from it's not even actually often the person who you're reporting about, but it's everyone around that person in an organization who freaks out, given like, why I can't believe this person's paid this much or this little, or why am I not being paid this much? I'll give you after you answer this question, I'll sort of give you a sense of what I've gotten from this. But what has been the feedback to that particular piece of information? Because I think within the walls of Bristol, there are probably people are like, oh, my God. I mean, this Mike Greenberg is making, you know, John Gruden-style money, among the highest paid on-air talents now at ESPN.
Right. Well, first of all, look, I don't do it that much. I mean— It sounds weird. I mean, I could do it a lot more, but I don't do it just to disrupt.
Yeah, or just to show off, like, hey, I got this number.
Yeah, that's just I usually do it when it's, you know, making a point, and it's part of a larger narrative about what's going on at ESPN. In this case, it was a larger part of what CA has been able to engineer for a client like Greenberg. You know, so that's why I did it. And I mean, the truth is, I think that people have a tendency right now about ESPN, given some of the departures in talent through the past 18 months, to think that the place is, you know, falling down. They're right. selling furniture. Yeah,
it's and Macedonia.
They're,
right.
They're not spending a lot of money on talent. Meanwhile, they spent enormous money on the NBA, the Big Ten, and when it's somebody that they really want, they either spend it or they were willing to spend it, as in the case with Skip
right.
Bayless. So those were and Colin Cowherd. Those were both of those guys got big offers from ESPN.
Correct.
And so I think that, you know, we just have to keep in mind that they still have money when they want to spend it.
All right. So Mike Greenberg gets this salary figure. And by the way, just as a quick aside, I literally must have heard from 25 ESPNers who, when you printed that, were like, oh, my God, I sort of can't believe this. And here's why. And most of them like Mike Greenberg, but it's a very competitive place. And I think there's a lot of people who think that if X talent should be paid this, then, you know, me as Y talent should be paid that. But Mike Greenberg, and I've written about this, it's very clear, Jim, you do not pay someone that kind of money to continue as the co-host of Mike and Mike and a simulcast on ESPN2. This would be sort of, we're going to theorize a little bit, and I want to get your take on this. Seems very clear that what the next move is going to be, and this is where CAA is always excellent, is Mike Greenberg fronting his own show, most likely on ESPN, most likely some kind of morning show that replaces the current SportsCenter, and maybe SportsCenter moves to ESPN2. I would think that Mike Greenberg's show probably goes to New York. I know he's had interest in that. We do know that Mike and Mike nearly moved to New York until ESPN management pulled the shelf on that.
Well, wait a second. Hold on.
Go ahead.
So ESPN announced that they're up fronts.
Correct.
That
yeah,
Mike
we were
and
both
Mike
there.
Were moving to New York.
Right.
And P.S., they didn't have the contract signed
right.
to do that. Note to file, try and have the contract signed before you announce something of the upfront.
Right.
Because at that point, the leverage was all with Mike and Mike. And I believe it was Lou Oppenheim who was...
That was Mike Greenberg's former agent.
Former agent.
Right.
So that was a tad askew.
So what do you think, though? What do you think, to me, I mean, again, you know, you wrote the book on these guys. It strikes me you do not pay someone that kind of money to continue in the same job that they currently have, correct? Would you agree with that or no?
Perhaps, but listen, they were the money that they were willing to spend on Skip Bayless, for instance, he was going to stay in the same job. People forget that.
Listen, and we can do a 15 hours on Bayless. That show overperforms at its time slot and was making money. Mike and Mike obviously makes money as well, but...
And it's tonnage.
And it's tonnage, right.
You got 8,760 hours.
But you still get the tonnage on a Mike Greenberg morning show on ESPN, right? A Good Morning America-style show, and your talent would be more happy, I would assume, doing that.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it may not be exclusive either of one another.
That's
one of the things you notice when you listen or watch Mike and Mike is every 15 seconds they're mentioning, and here's the progressive this, and here's the
right.
this and that. I mean, it is a heavily sponsored
show. It's a marketing show, would you agree?
It is a delivery system for cash.
Yeah, right.
And so, you know, he's making a lot of money. But the other thing is you got to think in the back of your mind about SportsCenter, and is there going to be some sort of role for Mike Greenberg with SportsCenter? Maybe, maybe not, but that is a franchise that is on life support, and they need to reinvigorate that. I happen to think that the best way to do it is through personalities. I think that they went...
Life support is a big word there. I'm not sure I'd go that far, would you? Wow.
Well, compared to...
What it was.
Compared to what it was. You know, I mean... I don't want good news to travel slow, so let's just say that they've done a pretty good job recently, in the recent past, of correcting what was, becoming a serious problem. And, you know, look, they had a huge new digital center. So SportsCenter was this cavernous, big, big stage with people that we really didn't know, people that seemed to be easily to switch off and on between each other, not distinct personalities, and they really suffered as a result. So if you have somebody like Greenberg who has a built-in, you know, kind of fan base to the degree that he does and knows it very well, he's very adept at that. Now, I'm not saying that's worth 6.75, but you know what? that's up to them to decide.
See, what's interesting to me about – well, actually, before I move on to that, does Mike Greenberg go to CAA because CAA can put him in this financial position compared to his previous agent? Or is there another reason why he heads to that firm? I really should mention his current agent, but because I know how much he dislikes having his name on airwaves. I won't. I'll just call him Kaiser for now. But but that strikes me as the reason you would make that move to CAA is because they – obviously, they have a ton of ESPN clients, but more than that, they can deliver that kind of money to a
deal. No, I think it's twofold. The value proposition is not only are we going to get you more money, but I think it's also, look, a lot of the sports agents of the past were very transactional-based. So right. It's like, you know, okay, my contract's up in 6 months, so I call my agent, and he says, oh, you know, let's work out a deal. This time I think we can get you this and this, and then they disappear for another 3 years. I think that... You know, Nick Kahn at CA and others, you know, they're trying to develop a holistic approach where it's not just about the deal. It's about, you know, every facet of your life. And, you know, it's not a dash, it's a marathon. And what does that mean? It also means that the marketing department at CA gets involved. It also means that there might be a sitcom. I mean, Jalen.
That's what I think it is. I think that Greenberg must have aspirations to go beyond ESPN into the ABC Disney family to do some kind of. Whatever.
Listen, I think I had to cut it because of space, but I don't know if it's been out there. But, you know, Jalen Rose has got a put pilot now.
About his life?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
And CA got it for him. And that's going to be, it's a pretty big deal.
Yeah.
You know, it'll be based on his life. And
that could be interesting. He's had actually a really interesting life. I actually love what he's doing now with his schools in Detroit. But that strikes me as there's a lot of people who are ESPNers who I think, and you know this just from all your reporting, who really want to cross over into the into popular culture. You agree? That's sort of, I mean, Coward wanted it bad. He nearly got it at CBS, I think. And there got to be others who just want that crossover world, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Michelle Beadle, there's a ton of them who've sort of done it or at least approached it because there's big money to be made there.
So if you have an agency that's adept at that, that's another compelling reason to switch over.
All right, so... Here's my thought then on Mike Greenberg. This is the kind of stuff that really is interesting to me. Whatever you think of him, and I know the criticisms, Mike Greenberg's too vanilla, Mike and Mike is a marketing show. I mean, I've called them Mike and marketing. I mean, nobody's lying. It's a soft landing base for a lot of interviews. I think Mike Greenberg's a talented broadcaster. I think he gets a little bit too much criticism for being part of the larger vanilla machine. But ESPN Radio... And they've been very honest about that. They're trying to appeal to the biggest possible audience. And because of that, they are intentionally, that show is not dangerous, not confrontational. And I think it lends towards certainly people being very comfortable there. But they, you know, that show's not Howard Stern, and it's not what you're going to hear on Sirius.
I mean,
just 1 second. All that said is I think there is a. There are numbers out of Mike and Mike. You know, they're averaging 250,000 on ESPN in terms of viewers. And I do wonder, and this is no disrespect to Mike Greenberg, if a Mike Greenberg-led show on ESPN is some kind of guaranteed ratings winner. I'm not sure I see that.
I don't know if it's a guaranteed ratings winner, but here's the thing. ESPN is so big, and there's so many hours. You got to think of it like Baskin-Robbins. There's like, you got to walk in, and there's like 31 flavors. So you got, you know, you used to have Stephen A. and Skip yelling at each other, and you got that kind of show.
Right.
And then you have, you know, a highly opinionated show. And so if there's something like Mike and Mike that's a little bit more accessible and plays between the proverbial 40-yard lines, then there's somebody for that too. I mean, 250,000 is not a bad number.
In sports, it depends. It's not a bad number against some of the other sports cable networks. It's a terrible number against anything on a bigger network. The Today Show, Good Morning America, CBS, Nickelodeon. I mean,
you can't
CNN's.
You know, that's apples and oranges, really. I mean, look, the truth is.
I guess you ultimately want eyeballs, no?
No, you want profits. You want a show that's going to deliver profitability and is not going to hurt the brand.
Right.
And
which that won't. I agree with that.
And if we go inside the Progressive, you know, hotline and all this other stuff, that show is a freaking cash machine.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I'm never discounting that the show isn't profitable. It does create, I think this is where, you know, whether it's the Connor Shells of the world, the Burke Magnuses, the Stephanie Drulies, Rob Kings, it becomes a little bit of a chessboard game because, you know, all the people who are currently on SportsCenter right now in the morning, Kevin Negandis and Jay Harris's, et cetera, Jamie Sire. You know, they read this stuff and they see the Greenberg contract and they're like, hey, you know, what is going to happen to us? You know, you put us on this morning show. We're trying to make it happen. Sometimes our ratings are really good. Sometimes they're not as good. But isn't that tough for I mean, you're more into this management world. Like, isn't that a tricky game for management to sort of placate four or five people who are currently on SportsCenter Morning now, knowing that Big Bad Mike Greenberg with the big contract potentially could be coming?
That's what those jobs are. Those jobs are placating
reputation
talent.
Reputation management?
You're placating talent. You're explaining it to talent. You're protecting talent. You're reprimanding talent. I mean, if you're, you know, that's, and by the way, they got over 1,000 people. So that's the deep end of the pool.
Right.
You spend your entire day doing that. And, you know, that, I mean, that's just part of the equation. I mean, now sometimes, look, I think when Gruden got over 6 million,
right,
that was something that, you know, a lot of people felt that inside the building. And so you know that sometimes there are certain salaries and certain people.
That's
that
the NFL, though, shouldn't you? I mean, I would expect. Wouldn't you expect the Gruden to get what Collinsworth or Sims are getting, that kind of money, or no?
You know,
he's not my favorite, but at least I sort of like at least that one I understand. I think that I would think the ones that might bother other staffers would be the in-house people, you know, non-coaches athletes when a broadcast.
And listen, it happened when Hannah and Josh Elliott were doing the live show in the morning. You know, people were a little resentful about their salaries.
Right.
I mean, you could go, you know, on and on and on. So
is the lesson here that we should all be in print so because nobody's making money and there's no jealousy?
No, the lesson is that, you know, these executives have to be really, really smart about how they manage talent and expectations.
Just because I want to piss off ESPN executives and others, what kind of salary does an ESPN exec make? I have my thoughts.
It depends on what level they are.
Let's for non-skipper level. A couple levels down from skipper. What is somebody? I don't want to mention any names to sort of call anybody out.
I mean, look, you know, there was an executive who got a promotion and, you know, he's making $750, $850.
Wow. What would that person be, let's say, in the chain? If John Skipper's one, where's the person making $750 in the management chain? Like, are they number 8 or are they number 15? Just so I have a sense.
No. I think you think about it as concentric circles. I mean,
okay.
Skipper has direct reports.
Right, he does.
Got a ton of direct reports. Right.
It's kind of a genius how he sort of warded off anybody for succession, John Skipper. He's he's like Napoleon there.
I always say Skipper needs a skipper.
He does.
I think that they've become very, very competitive with salaries.
Right. For executives.
For executives.
All right, so
the good news is you're living out in the middle of nowhere, so your cost of living, it's not like you're in New York City.
So you can afford a beach house on the Connecticut
Disney,
shore.
And Disney stock.
All right, so Disney stock is nice. So where is that I'm doing a terrible job of interviewing on this. Where is that $750,000 person on the chain? Is that a direct report to Skipper, or is that somebody below a direct report?
Are there direct reports to Skipper that are making $750? Yeah.
Wow. That's a pretty nice life to not be. You don't have the CEO title, but you're getting $750,000 plus Disney stock, plus a lot of the perks that come for working at ESPN, travel and stuff like that.
And some higher.
Nice. All right. Well, I learned something there. Let's finish up on this ESPN part on SportsCenter. You used the phrase life support before, which I noted and struck me. They are clearly, and I think I'm with you on this, I think this is the right strategy. I don't know if, ESPN has a lot of issues. We all know the subscriber base is going to continue to go down. SportsCenter is no longer the destination show because people's habits have changed. And, you know, my producer Lou Pellegrino can get scores and highlights on his phone essentially in real time. That's, you know, when me and you were growing up, you'd come home and you'd watch 11 o'clock SportsCenter, and, like, that was exciting because it was the first time you were going to get all those highlights.
Wait, Keith and Dan used to tease at a commercial. Coming up, we'll tell you what happened with the Giants and the Padres.
Right, right. And
we'd be sitting through the commercial, like, on the edge of our seat.
Yeah, it was like revolutionary in the 90s. All right, so that's obviously that world has changed in 2016. What they've clearly made a decision on is to go personality first. Van Pelt's show, I think, has sort of been the blueprint for that, even though these other shows aren't going to, there's only Van Pelt has his own sensibilities and his own producers. They made the announcement for Jermell Hill and Michael Smith. So that's two personalities out of the His and Hers franchise. They're going to get the 6 o'clock one. I think that's a very tough spot to rate, but I wish them the best. I think they've worked hard. So it's very clear, let's say Greenberg goes to the morning, gets, let's say, some kind of GMA-style sports center. So is this is we agree, right? This the good, bad, or indifferent, they're doubling down on the franchise bet that now you are going to want to hang out with certain personalities watching SportsCenter, and there'll also be highlights and some conversation. But ultimately, it's personality-driven, and they're betting that people want to spend an hour with said personality, right?
I hope so, because what's most important is that they turn the page on the previous strategy, which was this, you know, stage that looked like the inside of Radio City Music Hall. And,
which was, you know, a fortune. You talk about the $120 million stage. Still there, right?
Yeah, but I mean, when they debuted it and when the whole big and, you know, thrust of the new era of SportsCenter was this, you know, huge stage and a parade of people coming in and out that weren't particularly distinguished in terms of either we
but
knew them
do, wasn't
or
that
they,
a, wasn't that co- you're this is your world, you're so much smarter than me on this. No. Isn't that the way to drive costs down though on salaries? It's like if you have these indistinguishable anchors, you don't have to pay them Patrick and Oberman money, right? Or no?
Well, first of all, I mean, SportsCenter is for many, many years, it was one of the main arteries of ESPN.
Right.
I mean, yes, the NFL rights and the dual revenue stream, whatever, but SportsCenter was really, really important. You know, Warren Buffett used to say that, you know, somebody's sitting in the shade right now because a long time ago somebody planted a tree. So you understand this technological revolution that's coming, like you were just talking about, in terms of access to scores and everything else. So what do you do about it? I mean, first they did 3D, which was, you know, the like proverbial pothole in the road, because that was a lot of money and that dog didn't hunt. Right. So, I mean, you know, where was the look ahead to say, okay, we have to make sure that we don't get caught? And I think that, you know, look, they do a lot of things really well, and it's not like they sit around in meetings trying to be silly or trying to get caught. But I think this is one of those occasions where I think that I know that they realized that they got caught. And so they didn't have an answer. They tried the big, you know, digital soundstage with all these things, but why try and save money on something like SportsCenter? I mean, save money by doing other things, but don't, you know.
Well, they're going to save money now by doing remotes, like broadcasting from Bristol with the announcers, right? And just shooting the game from wherever. That should save a lot of money as we head forward. First of all, are you happy with the podcast? I think we're 20 minutes in. Everything going okay?
I'm good.
All right.
I'm low maintenance, so.
You're too low maintenance, actually. I feel like you need to be more of a diva. I have this running sort of dialogue with ESPN PR. I mean, I have like a million of these dialogues. This is one particular topic. I should get into the fact that I'm very annoyed with them at their overmanaging of always having to sit on executive calls either via phone or in person. They're ridiculous. I mean, not other networks do that, but that's a topic for another day. I'll probably not get some. I'll probably be banned like you were from Bristol for 3 minutes after that line. But here's the thing. I do have this long conversation. And ESPN PR, when I talk to them about this, I'm not going to mention any names, sort of calling anybody out. I think they're sympathetic with me, but they say it's sort of this is the business we've chosen. It's always frustrating to me, Jim, that there's always seemingly money for certain talents, and in particular certain bloviators, while they're laying off longtime producers, longtime news editors. So help me reconcile that there was a more than $4 million offer for Skip Bayless, but yet within the sort of same relative time frame, they're laying off a couple hundred people who really sort of will be hurt by losing their job and were grinders and did stuff. So is that you've written the Saturday Night Live book, you are in this entertainment world. Is that just something that I need to just sort of grow up and understand that like talent is always going to be in this different box versus the rank and file?
Well, yes, to a certain degree, because if it's successful talent, then it will ultimately save jobs, right? Because if it's a great talent and people are watching that show, then the people on that show, just think about that. They're part of a winning streak,
that's
right?
That's a great point.
I mean, that's really important. The second thing is that on a holistic view, it's not necessarily binary in their money, in their mind. It's different buckets. Yes, there is an overall budget, and yes, they have to deliver to Burbank certain results. But it doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, look, when they didn't, see, think of the money they saved between Colin Cowherd, Skip Bayless, and Keith Oberman, and Bill Simmons. Do you want to run the numbers right now?
15 million? This is a guess. I don't know. Four of those guys,
five,
you'd know better
four,
than me.
Two. You know, so I mean those are significant dollars,
right?
But it's not like they went out and then hired 300 people back.
True,
it's you know what I mean.
Well, I think that money you can make the argument has gone to other talent, including Greenberg, right, and including other people they've re-signed.
But it also, listen, look at, I mean, for everything we can say about cord cutting, look at what they spent on the NBA and the Big Ten.
Yeah, true. I mean, but that's their strategy. Their strategy is live, right? Live sports, high premium live sports. That means you're going to always want our
I'm
network.
I'm just saying, though, that's
no matter what you pay.
That's money that could go towards that.
Right.
I mean, it's a big ecosystem, and there's lots of different variables.
There are a lot of places that have written about declining subscriptions at ESPN, and there are certain places that write about it that are just clearly doing it for their, both page view play as well as to take shots at ESPN. I understand that. As someone who sort of marinated in that business for a long time, how dire do you think that situation is? You know, at a certain point, the declining subs are going to stop declining, and maybe it ends at, I'm making this up, maybe it ends at 60, maybe it ends at 55, maybe it ends at 75, or maybe at a certain point they go direct to consumer and they're like, if you want our product, we're going to charge you $30 a month. And you're going to get all these, you know, incredible live sports that we have. What do you say?
First of all, on a micro level, I wouldn't even go to $30 a month. I would say we should have the equivalent of what iTunes is. Basically, you know, I want to wake up in the morning and I want to buy a song, so I go on iTunes and I pay $1.99.
It's almost like the pay-per-view model.
Yeah. What if I just want to, you know, watch a great game tonight, basketball game tonight? I go on and I pay the money for that. You know,
you think consumers would do that on a day-to-day? I mean, maybe they would, but that would
first of all, we're already trained to do it because we've been through. I mean, obviously, Spotify has disrupted iTunes to a certain degree.
That's interesting.
But we still have that. We're very capable of that.
Right.
You know, it's not
if the system's in place for you to easily click a button.
I mean, the iTunes store with songs could be the ESPN store years from now
that's
games. Or, you know, I mean, so I don't have to pay for the whole NBA channel. I just
then you charge like $20 for the NCAA, like for the NFL, the college football championship, something like that.
Yeah.
That'd be really interesting.
Whatever it is. But so that's the micro level. On the biggest level, let's just remember something. Like, I'm not blowing smoke here, but like Bob Iger's one of the most successful media executives
Absolutely.
Of all time.
Yeah.
I'm not like talking about like the last 10 years. I'm not talking about like the last 20 years. Like what he has done, if you were smart enough to buy Disney stock for your kid's college account the day that he became chairman, they can go to graduate school, get a PhD, go to med school, and do everything else as a result.
Sounds good.
Like at some point, you know, don't bet against them.
No, that's good. You should be one of Skipper's reports. I almost bought that. All right. Before we move on from this topic, you want to make some news here? Am I allowed to bring up a topic on something you're working on? Or
I have no idea what you're talking about.
All right. I've become aware that I don't know when it's going to come out, but you are currently reporting another ESPN oral history or book from the conclusion of when the previous book ended to present day, which would theoretically include the dissolution of Grantland, sort of some of the turbulent times for ESPN now in terms of declining subs, to everything that's happened between, to Bayless leaving, et cetera. Is this correct? Is there going to be either a sequel or a new ESPN book?
I mean, look, have I been doing some interviews? Yes. These books are like, you can't date them, you got to marry them.
Right.
So, like, I'm still...
You're dating.
I think that there's a shorter book to be had that about the last 7-8 years, there's a lot to be talked about. I don't really like the idea of going backwards, but this is a pretty big matzo ball, and it's worth, it may be worth... doing that.
Okay, so the previous book hit number one on the New York Times bestseller list. So I'll make the presumption that you have either contacted or been contacted, that if you do proceed or decide to do this, there's a publisher and everything set in place. I mean, people would be crazy not to do this. I mean, your book was number one on the New York Times bestseller. Is that a fair assumption?
I mean, I'd like to think that's the case, yes.
Can you give any kind of indication as to how far along you are on the interview process?
I mean, look, I wanted to make sure that it's like spring training. You feel like your swing's back or whatever. I think that there are enough people who are interested in talking and who have talked that makes me feel like it's possible.
Now, you're like Podesta and Kellyanne Conway on these answers. I keep trying here.
Thank you so much.
How much would Simmons and the Grantland disillusion be a part of this book could be.
Listen, it was a serious blip on the radar. Mm-hmm. I wrote, I think, 4 or 5 columns for Vanity Fair on it.
Right.
And that was a lot of fun. But I also feel like this time out...
What's the biggest thing that happened after your book to present day? that it, at ESPN? What would you say is sort of the biggest story that you would want to delve into?
I mean, I think there's probably three in three different areas. One is the economic model changed.
Right.
The second is that people like Bill Simmons and Skip and Keith Olbermann and Colin left. There were a lot of notable departures and lots of stories around that.
Yeah.
I don't think we can forget about, you know, it's probably an extension of the economic model changing, but I think that the 300 people who were laid off was, you know, particularly for a place like ESPN that has been
with lifetime
for many
jobs,
years,
you thought.
Yeah, yeah, and was able to avoid that. I thought that was really serious. And, you know, I really would like to probably get deeper into Skipper and the Skipper era.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay, so last one on this. The at this point, given that you have interviewed so many of the people you would re-interview, do you make those contacts directly, or do you in some way work with ESPN's public relations apparatus to make that happen?
You mean right now, currently?
Yeah, because that's an interesting thing, because there are there will be people who are currently working at ESPN who theoretically you would want to interview. Now, do you, and you know them, you have personal relationships with them. Do you go directly to them because you have a personal relationship with them from previous reporting in the books, or do you have to go through official channels on something like this?
I mean, I talk to a lot of people there, but I think that if I was officially working on a book, I would be, you know, respectful of both the people themselves and also
that's
of
fair.
Of Chris and his team, Chris LeBlanc and his team, to, you know, I don't want to be surreptitious. There's no need for that.
It's fine. You banned once from that campus, and you don't want to be banned again is what you're telling me.
Well, I mean, at the beginning—
Isn't it cool, though, to be banned from ESPN at one point? Like, that is badass to me. That's in all your success, for all your bestsellers and all that stuff, that might be the thing I think is the coolest thing about you, is that at one time you were banned from ESPN's campus.
Well, they had made a decision that they didn't want to—
You're like Two Live Crew. You're banned, basically.
Oh, yeah, that's me. Yeah, that's me.
LaPlaca will be Tip of Gore here. So, yeah, they made a decision that—
They didn't
a foolish
want to
one, right? But then they were like, then they smartly were like, you know what? It's ultimately good publicity for our company. The guy's doing an oral history.
Well,
of
I think
who we are.
I don't know about good publicity. I think they figured that book was going to be done anyway,
right?
And listen, I tend to focus on the 2 years that I was on campus, and they were very hospitable, rather than the year or year and a half when
You were banned.
Yeah, couldn't get.
Did you buy a T-shirt that said "banned from ESPN"?
No, my style.
Awesome. Your kid should have bought that. All right. Let us move on to one of your favorite topics, Fox Sports 1. You are someone who loves the Fox Sports 1 brass. Is that true?
How is that?
Jamie Horowitz, and one of my previous guests, John Orand, I picture you guys lobstering somewhere in the Pacific Palisades.
It's so funny.
Is that
I love how you jump.
You're on
to
a
these,
boat somewhere, and you're eating shrimp.
Well, there's plenty of boats lurking around
Pacific
Palisades.
I was told that you guys are tight, but maybe my information is wrong. All right, where do you see Fox Sports 1 right now in their competition with NBC Sports and ESPN? Bayless has now had a couple of months doing his show. You know, Jamie's brought other former ESPN talents there, most recently Chris Carter. Ray Lewis has a spot there. Rob Parker is back there. Interestingly, this is interesting for you, he's got a lot of behind-the-scenes people he brought with the Wit Albums and Gabe Goodwin's of the world. I know I feel like you're tighter to ESPN's world than Fox Sports 1's world, but what have, as an observer from afar, what have you seen from them, and what do you see from them heading forward?
I mean, look, the first thing is contextual, and no disrespect to, I love your tweets about, you know, Fox Sports 1, but here's the thing. Jamie has spent some money on talent.
Definitely.
He's also
might
saved
not be the right
some,
talent, but it's talent.
He's also saved some money. I'm not a defender, but
yes,
you have
yes.
to, I'm just saying, though,
I understand.
If we're going to actually
I know what you're going to get into. Like, yeah, what he did is I loathe the idea of cutting all news and journalism, but that saved millions.
But he canceled a couple shows that were, you know, north of $15 million he was saving.
Right.
So,
I understand.
You know, so I think that that's important. The second thing is cultural. If he is creating a world at Fox Sports 1 that is more talent friendly,
I think he's done that. Yeah.
I mean, look, Colin Cowherd looked me right in the face and said, you know, the money was basically the same at ESPN. So he didn't leave ESPN for money. He left because he felt like he wanted to be in a different place culturally.
Well, California versus Bristol is a different, that's a different conversation too, right?
No, but I think Colin's point wasn't about geography. It was about the culture at the place and how they treated talent and how they wanted to work with talent and a partnership.
Right. But that's not just – I didn't mean to interrupt you, but that's not just Fox Sports 1 and Jamie Horowitz. Eric Shanks and John Entz at Fox Sports, and before that David Hill and Ed Gorin, had the reputation far and away of being the most talent-friendly sports shop that existed. That was part of Fox's kind of, you know, they always like to think of themselves as pirates from Rupert Murdoch, et cetera. But they were incredible with talent, and that I think that history continues today. That's the one place, if you look at, always let its sports talent cross over and do commercials and stuff. I mean, Aaron Andrews has become super rich because Fox has always been good about allowing talent to do other stuff. Terry Bradshaw. So I agree with you on the Jamie part, but I would just counter and say that I feel like that's a longstanding Fox thing, that whatever you think about them, they've always been great with letting talent sort of be who talent is.
Right, right. But I think that, look, there are other places that are talent friendly too, but my only point is
CBS,
I think that, I think they all are, except that I think that at some point during the waning days of the Wildhack administration, you know, I like John, but I think that, you know, talent was feeling a little under siege.
Yeah.
And so it wasn't about, I mean, I think that all the other sports networks had pretty good relations with talent, but I think that there was a time there where ESPN was perceived not to. And so there was an exodus.
Right.
And I think that was significant. So, I mean, look, the truth is that the short answer and the simple answer is, it's too soon to tell.
Right.
I mean, it's not a cop-out. It just is. I mean, these things take, you know, a long time, and they're like moving, you know, an aircraft carrier in a narrow port. It's very hard to change.
But do you think, I don't even want to say, do you think debate style television from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. is a smart strategy? Let's forget about that. Both of us have talked about this. Everybody, I think, knows where I stand. I think they know where you stand too. More than that is it good to have, let's say, guys like Skip Bayless as your front men for your network? If that's what you are associated with first and foremost, is that a good or bad thing, and why?
Well, it's not necessarily de facto branding of the entire network, but what it could be is a lightning rod for a morning, you know? So if you want to have a morning where a bunch of, you know, hungover college kids sit there and watch these, you know, people yell at each other and disagree about stuff that you have an opinion on, then it helps to have like some alpha creatures, and you know, they'll bring them to them. I mean, remember something. Sometimes with Skip and Stephen A, it's the old Howard Stern thing, right? People used to listen to him for 25 minutes,
watching, right?
And then the people who really hated him listened for 45.
Right.
So,
but that hasn't been the case yet. I mean, again, it's early, but you know, that show, it's still trailing First Take 3-1. The other FS1 shows have not really rated well. But I also agree with you. I think, and I've tried to sort of do this too, you really have to wait a while to judge a network strategy when new people come in and change it. I don't think debate in a culture where there's just already so much debate, and particularly locally, is a winning strategy long term from 9 to 6 p.m. on a cable.
Well, that's a pretty long stretch. So, you know, we'll see. But listen, sometimes it could also be when the Lord wants to punish you, he answers your prayers. And if you think that ESPN is, you know, just, you know, so bad. I mean, those four letters still carry a lot of weight.
Definitely.
And there's a huge, huge machine behind it, which is, you know, marketing and all sorts of other, you know, vertical integration that can lead to success on a show. So,
yeah, you do. The one thing is true. You do learn when people go to other networks. And again, they're certainly compensated financially, you know, dreamland. But you really do learn quickly just how powerful the marketing machine of ESPN is, and how you can essentially, I'm not saying this even flippantly, but you can put like sort of two moderately talented on-air people on ESPN at a certain time slot, and they're going to rate. I mean, it's just like people... That is a de facto channel for so many sports fans just sitting on in the background. And it's just, it really is incredible when you sometimes see their numbers versus other networks. Even as ESPN is losing viewership on some of their franchises, it's still blowing away other sports networks at those time slots.
I mean, listen, what Jamie's up against is right now, you know, there are thousands of bars that are, you know, everybody's scrubbing the bar and they're setting the tables and they're getting ready for tonight's. And, you know, they're going to set their TVs to ESPN.
Always.
And so, like, so is Jamie going to be able to engineer something where that changes? You know, that's one way of looking at success. You know, obviously the numbers are another way.
Right. All right. So listen, you filibuster for Jamie Horowitz. This is why you've become a good CIA agent for him.
Oh my God.
The CIA is sort of running FS1.
Going to have me with the Russians pretty soon.
All right. Here, I'm just going to just change it up really quick. Is it easier to interview a sports media person with a huge ego or someone with no ego? What's the easier, harder interview?
I think
Or do you enjoy one more than the other? Do you enjoy the alpha male versus the... Not even alpha male, but like, is interviewing Chris Berman a more interesting experience than interviewing, let's say, an Adnan Burke? One guy who's sort of ego, blustery, blah, blah, blah. Adnan sort of feels like more, you know, Canadian, thoughtful, moderate.
Well, I mean, look, Chris is probably going to say more provocative things, and there's a larger body of evidence. I mean, there's just a wider range of questions you can ask.
Right.
And then there's always the, you know, the questions that you're really not supposed to ask or shouldn't ask, but then you ask anyway. So there's more of that with those kinds of people.
Diplomatic answer again. All right, what will 2017 be like for Bill Simmons? What's he going to do? You're a Bill Simmonsologist.
Oh, my gosh. You know what? I actually think that 2016 was instructive for him. Huh. I think it was, clarifying in some ways. I think his comments following the cancellation of the show, I thought were introspective.
Yeah, and, thoughtful. I agree.
You know, he wasn't trying to fool anybody, including himself. So I think that what you're going to see in 17 is a guy who is still really, really dedicated to the stuff that he wants to do and has a kind of a chip on his shoulder. And even though things may be, you know, successful in certain areas, the fact that he went through this TV thing, I don't think he's looking for 17 to be another, you know, oh, how can I get back on TV? I think he's going to focus on, I mean, he's got a lot of projects. I hope he gets a chance to even write even more. For me, you know, the biggest thing about the TV show was he's not writing as much.
Right.
I mean, there's just not enough hours in the day. So I think that that's, when he writes, that's a lot of oxygen in the room.
Do you read The Ringer regularly?
I do.
What do you think of it?
I do. I think that, look, I mean, there's some really talented people. I don't think that it's the, it's easy to say this because Grantland was so new to us. And so there was just something, you know, wonderful about it.
Right.
And the way that it, we saw it from day one and we grew up with it and whatever. I still think that Grantland in Bill's heyday was, you know, a better product than The Ringer today. But I also feel like we're still not comfortable enough with the Ringer universe where we navigate it like we used to with Grantland. So the more that he writes, the more that other people write. I mean, he's got some great writers though, and certainly a couple of really world-class editors too.
Yeah. Well, you love Brian Curtis. You've always been a Brian Curtis guy.
Curtis, Sean Fantasy. I mean, this is very, very, really.
Yeah, I'm a little down on Curtis right now. I feel like he took a couple shots at me, but he's a really talented guy.
He's really talented.
But I make everything personal, so that's on me. Well, here's the thing with The Ringer though. I think that some of it too is that at Grantland had more established writers from the jump that you might have known. The Ringer has a lot of younger writers that perhaps as you continue to read their work, you will know. And I'm not even talking about the Gladwells, but I think if, you know, even like, I'm trying to think of the beginning. They're just, if you look at that staff, I'd have to sort of have it in front of me. I think even the younger writers at Grantland were a little more well established in the market than the younger writers today at The Ringer, which I do think would lead you to have more interest in that site. Am I right about that, you think, or no?
I don't know. I'm probably not qualified to answer that. But you know what?
Ringer still has, between Curtis and Katie Baker and Robert Mays. I mean, there's, you know, and many others. You know, there is a lot of talent there. But I agree with you. There's something, I don't know how to sort of say it. Is it just to go back to the ESPN thing that maybe because it doesn't have the massive distribution and marketing that it's just not in my face as much?
Look, I feel like there's a lot of good stuff on it. I don't think it's as, we have, at least me and several of my friends, not as if this is the right word, as intimate a relationship with it as we did with Grantland.
Yeah, that's well said.
That it was,
why, though? That's the question, is why.
I think part of it is just because Grantland and the way Bill, they launched it, it became so pronounced. It just, it was instantly something that you went to every day. It was consistent. You know, we just, I don't know, I just feel like a step behind maybe, you know. And you know what? That doesn't mean that they won't get there. And in some ways, they may already be there. I don't know. I mean, I don't look at their metrics a lot versus Grantland. I try not to judge it in terms of numbers.
Yeah.
I mean, look, there's quality writing there all the time.
Right.
You know, I miss Wesley. I miss, you know, people that have graduated.
Yeah, Brian Phillips. I mean, there's a lot of people who are at Grantland who are not there at The Ringer who are just, I mean, major, major talents. Rembert Brown. And so, all right, you're doing okay? I mean, I got like one more section here.
Go for it.
Yeah, you have a meeting coming up, I've heard.
I'm fine.
All right, you're always meeting with famous people and stuff. You when you come to the city, it's like it's like MacArthur coming here, or Neil Armstrong.
Are you following me?
Yes, I am. I have a whole team of people following me.
I don't tweet about anything about that I do.
I've heard. I've been told. My research is good on this. Okay. All right, let's talk about Saturday Night Live. This is one of your favorite topics. You know, you and Lorne Michaels are tight. You guys summer together. You're summering in like in where? In Orient.
Yeah.
I thought, this is just me, I thought Dave Chappelle and Lin-Manuel's opening monologues this year were among the 10 best I've ever seen on Saturday Night Live. Incredible. For different reasons. Chappelle telling the story about going to the White House and Obama, that was an incredible story. And poignant and sort of about sort of his approach to Donald Trump. You know, he's a brilliant stand-up, but that was sort of brilliant stuff. And then Lin-Manuel doing the Hamilton rift was incredible. I don't know where the show is right now, but I thought those two opening monologues were as good as I've ever seen. How do you, when you're watching Saturday Night Live, given that you are like one of the foremost historians of that show in the country, how do you view this cast and what we're seeing today versus even 5-10 years ago?
Look, I was there Saturday night and I had to see Chance live.
Oh, I heard he was great.
Oh my gosh, he is, yeah. He's just the varsity. My daughter has been listening to him for 5 years.
Did you wish she with you?
Yeah.
Oh, you're like dad of the father of the year.
You know, and this year he's
you're
nominated
like the
guy for
who
new
takes
artist.
His kid to Taylor Swift.
No, Sophie was like onto that like 5 years ago, but he was amazing. I mean, look, the truth is that every season of SNL, it's like an EKG. There's going to be, you know, great episodes. There's going to be great sketches, and there's going to be, you know, some misses. But to watch Dave Chappelle that night, I mean,
were you there in this?
No, I wasn't there that night. But you know what? Saturday Night Live is the only show that could deliver something like that.
I agree.
I mean, I'm sorry. There's just, even if he came out and did stand up on, you know, Jimmy or, you know, whatever, there's no way. So I think that there's an X factor to Saturday Night Live, which is still very important. I also feel like, you know, they met the challenge of the election. They were relevant. They were talked about. They were, you know, retweeted and, I mean, more people watch them the day after or, you know, off of clips than watch the show itself. And the show was a part of the political process, as it's been for, you know, many times before. So I don't think they missed a beat on that. Certainly Alex's portrayal of Trump helped quite a bit. But it also, you have to get back to Kate McKinnon is... I mean, she is
she's
the varsity.
A stand, yeah, for
she
sure. Stand out of that show.
She is the varsity.
All right, so a couple things on this. The... it's very clear that the president-elect watches Saturday Night Live because he often tweets about it. How does that impact Saturday Night Live, if at all? Do they, if a, you know, this is sort of new ground here. It's not like Gerald Ford would tweet out, "How dare you, Chevy Chase, for mocking me." I mean, Trump watches it. He's kind of obsessed by it. So how do you think that impacts, does Saturday Night Live continue to step on the gas and sort of mock him, or... could they ever be impacted the other way and sort of back down if the heat's too much?
Well, a couple of things. First of all, they're an equal opportunity offender. So it's not like, you know, they do this to every president. Obama was the toughest
right.
because he doesn't have any handles. It's just a weird, he doesn't have any ticks.
And they couldn't find somebody to do him. He's just Fred really, Anderson wasn't that great.
But he's just like a really hard guy.
I agree.
Like he doesn't, I mean, I've talked to the writers and performers about this. This is just a really hard guy to do.
Right.
But the point is, though, they did it to Democrats. They did it to Republicans. They're going to do it to Trump. The difference is that, I mean, look, Bush 41 actually had Dana Carvey appear with him at an event.
Right.
You know, Bill Clinton used to joke about Phil Hartman's McDonald's
right.
sketch.
Right.
So they all kind of took it in stride. I don't think W was as enamored of, you know, Will Ferrell's, you know.
yeah.
But a lot of people think that Will Ferrell helped W because they made him to seem like a guy you want to have a beer with.
Right.
You know, just a lovable guy.
Will Ferrell's always W. He's always like Ricky Bobby to me a little bit, right?
right. But, you know, the point is, though, the fact that now Trump, like, he didn't actually do anything this Saturday night, though, I noticed. He didn't say anything.
Yeah.
Didn't tweet anything. So maybe,
that's interesting.
Maybe he's now been convinced, you know, to leave it alone. But it doesn't matter. They're not going to change either. If he tweets about every single show for the next 6 months, or if he doesn't tweet at all, they're going to do what they want to do. I mean, unless they decided to, like, literally do a navel-gazing sketch about him tweeting about SNL, which would be kind of hard to pull off. But otherwise, they're, you know, that show doesn't get intimidated by much.
The I want to ask you about McKinnon's Hallelujah performance. That was Leonard Cohen died that week. He's the writer of that amazing song. And it was interesting. The reason why that performance was really interesting was because I saw people who were either Democrats or Clinton supporters or people who really just loathed Trump, like, thought that performance was incredible. On the opposite side, those who are conservatives – who either support Trump or are just sort of really Hillary haters, thought it was absolutely perverse that she would be that political and say, I think she said something like, I'm not giving up, neither should you. Like, it was an outright, basically, here's where either AI stand or be the show stands. That was really fascinating to me, just as a media observer, that they did that. How did you – this is the singular question when I knew you were going to be my podcast guest today, I wanted to ask you, was how did you view that particular moment?
I think it's an outlier. I mean, if you look at 42 seasons of Saturday Night Live, I think one of the things that they've tried to do, I was just referring to it, is, you know, they try and be Switzerland. They try and, you know, whether it was Dandy Aykroyd did Nixon sketches. I mean, throughout, you've never seen an agenda, rarely. I mean, people used to ascribe an agenda to them. Oh, Jim Downey's a real conservative, so he's trying to beat up on this one or that one. But there really wasn't one. I think that moment was one of those moments where they just decided to go to a place. Now, I don't think that there are a lot of people at the show who think that it was as, like, politically pointed as it was.
But it was that's how people react. I think
a lot of people did, and I think they're smart enough to know that. I think that there was, you know, there were probably a lot of other possibilities that they considered. So maybe this was not as much of a response. But I think it is notable. It was serious. I don't know if it crossed the line, but it skated right up to it. And, you know, I think, look, Lorne does things for a lot of different reasons. And I don't think he did something to – I think he actually may have done it to be a cathartic moment for some people who had a really tough week, as opposed to – like planting a flag saying, okay, we're going to be, you know, the show of opposition.
Right.
I don't believe that.
Do you think that McKinnon's line was written, or do you think she said it ad lib?
Oh, I would doubt if she said it out lib, but you know what? I don't know for a fact, so I don't want to say it. But I
agree with you.
I
didn't know if she said, you know, you're a performer, you're in the moment.
By the way, ad libs, by general, it's not a great thing on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, probably dangerous. I mean,
People who have decided to ad lib, particularly in monologues and opens,
They don't come back?
No.
Someone like Kate McKinnon, who is pretty close to fronting movies now on her own, I mean, how long can someone like that stay on that show? Is this it? 1 year?
No, listen, Kristen Wiig, God bless her, she came back after Bridesmaids.
Right.
You know, I mean, think about that for a moment.
Right.
I mean, that movie is huge, and she was huge in it. And thus the legacy of Saturday Night Live, because you think, oh my gosh, what's going to happen without Kristen Wiig? And then all of a sudden, you know, I think 80's great. But here's,
you know, criminally underrated as an all-time performer, Kenan Thompson. He is a
fantastic,
great third man, like in a sketch or second man. The sketches that he obviously leads are great, but he is never not funny. In a sketch.
He's first man a lot of times. He is the gift that keeps giving.
Yeah.
And he's been there for a long time.
For a long time.
He's fantastic.
He's, I don't know, who was there the long, it was Ferrell, I'm trying to think of what cast member was there the longest, because Kenan will be Keenan may have a shot at that if he decides to stay. Do you know who the longest tenured member ever?
I believe Daryl.
How long was How long was he there for?
Maybe 14. I'm not sure.
What's Keenan on? Like 10 or 11 now?
He's getting up there. Right? Keenan's getting up there. But you know, we thought 2 years ago that he was. There's a rumor that he was leaving, and just delighted that he was going to stay. I mean, and he's so good. And he's so versatile, and you know, he just. When you see him, you already start to smile.
I literally could do a whole Saturday Night Live podcast with you. I'm fascinated by that show. Is it a lucrative job financially for the cast?
Compared to like being on, being on a sitcom?
Yeah,
no.
Yeah. Like, no. Yeah. Not close, right?
No, but I mean.
But you can make. But I mean, you can live in New York very comfortably with what they pay you. Or
yeah, okay. Yeah, and plus you're doing 20 shows.
Right. So you can do other stuff.
You can do other stuff.
Right.
And you know, I think that Lorne has proven to be. You know, incredible. I mean, look, he has constructs, but there have been times when he's been, you know, flexible. It's not like, you know, you can go shoot a movie the first 5 weeks of the show.
Right.
But no, there's 20 weeks. And it's also, again, it's not just about the money. It's about you're able to showcase yourself.
You're also doing something relevant, right?
Yeah.
How great is that?
And there's a pretty good track record of people on Saturday Night Live going elsewhere. I mean, sometimes, though, it's just a destination. You know, a lot of people think of it as, oh, the vehicle for getting the sitcom or the movie deal or whatever. And sometimes for a lot of people, it's just like, hey, I'm here. This is all I wanted. And this has been great. And thank God, you know.
Because you have that, though, there are so many careers that sort of even reinvented themselves. Like Norm MacDonald's career has been fascinated, but he always will have that. I don't even know how long he was on the show for. But he can always sort of point back to that, even when he's selling himself today or thought of as a stand-up. If he ever did news commentary, he did Weekend Update, I think, for a year.
I'd love to do a Broadway show about the relationship between Norm MacDonald and Don Ohlmeyer.
By the way, one of the great – I may have seen this from Ryan Glassbeagle, the big lead, but he sort of tweeted this out. But there's a YouTube video which has every Norm MacDonald O.J. Simpson joke for the whole season. Anybody who's listening to this, you should check this out. That guy went after O.J. Simpson as hard as I've seen any comic on a network television go after him. And rightfully so, by the way. In hindsight, it sort of comes up. But Ohlmeyer, who obviously was O.J.'s buddy, you could, if nothing else, sort of understand why Ohlmeyer eventually – not eventually, but Ohlmeyer fired him. Because those jokes – I don't even know who the writer was. They were as harsh as I've ever seen – on network TV. Have you ever seen that video of the – it's like a 20-minute video of just Norm MacDonald's O.J. jokes within the Weekend Update monologue.
But in fairness to Don, he also felt – listen, he didn't like Adam Sandler, and Adam Sandler wasn't doing O.J. jokes.
By the way, Don Ohlmeyer famously became what? The ESPN ombudsman.
That's right.
Go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt. So, Don – is the lesson of this that Don Ohlmeyer's eye for talent is not good?
No. Don Ohlmeyer's – eye for talent is pretty damn good. It may not be.
I know he's a legend.
It may not be as good in comedy as it is in, let's say, sports or in entertainment.
I get that. But you love defending these executives. My God, weren't you in iconoclast when you were younger?
No, I just don't. We live in a world where good news travels slow. I just try and nobody.
Where'd your kids go to college? The Kremlin?
Here's the thing, though. I could sit down and I could rip anybody. It's easy to do, but I just, you know, if you're, by the way, all I'm trying to do is do the flip side of the coin because you're like, you know.
I'm not the always attack dog, but I mean, like, it's hard for me. I love Norm MacDonald, so I have to be against Donald.
I love Norm MacDonald.
How can you not be?
Oh, my God. Norm
MacDonald.
By
hilarious.
The way, Jim Downey. We're doing a lot of that right.
Yeah, genius, Jim Downey.
Jim Downey is.
The writers on Saturday Night Live are geniuses. I don't know what happens to them after they leave Saturday Night Live, but they're so absurdly talented.
Yeah, you think about when Tina was head writer. That was.
And Amy Poehler must be a brilliant writer too, right? You know all
she
these.
She had
guys.
All these UCB training, United Citizens Brigade training, and
amazing.
Pretty.
Do you keep in contact with these guys? Like, are you personal friends with any of these people that you wrote about in the book? You don't have to mention names to name drop, but are you? Like, could you go out to dinner with former performer X tonight if you gave him a call on the cell? That's a yes.
Yeah.
Oh, look at you, buddy. We need to hang out more. You have far more. My friends are 2-year-olds in diapers. I am not. All right.
Those are the best friends of
yes.
all.
All right. We're almost at an hour. Is there anything you need to add to me?
I think we should put people out of their misery.
All right. There were a couple questions I didn't get to from some listeners. I'll like ask that here. We'll just lightning round this for 30 seconds. Is there any sports media person out there that you think has the best chance of successfully launching their own site, like The Vertical or The Ringer? Like, is there anybody out there in sports media land that you think can do what a Simmons did or a Peter King did or a Wojnarowski did? That's not the easiest question to call, but I'm not sure there is.
You know what? I'm not sure there is. And by the way, I'm not sure that it's worth it.
Why do you say that?
Because it's a pain in the ass. It's a lot of work, and it distracts you. Then you become a manager as opposed to a content creator. You know, it's not for everybody. I mean,
what person should host Saturday Night Live who hasn't?
I know for years and years they wanted Tom Cruise, who
he never did the show.
No, wow. I mean, he's dyslexic, so cue cards might be a problem. I'm not sure, but I'll tell you something. I interviewed that guy during
the CIA book. That was an incredible get by you.
He's pretty amazing.
His career is incredible. But it's a once-in-a-lifetime career.
And the way he talks and sees the business and understands the business, that was pretty cool.
Very cool. Although, you know, there's a lot with Cruise Scientology and stuff. If you ever could get the full story on Tom, it'd be one of the most fascinating profiles ever. I will say this. He is about the template, maybe DiCaprio is too, in terms of sort of going from, I don't know if Cruise was a child star, but he was a teenage star.
He was 19 when he was hired by
Taps.
But when he came to CA, he was 19. Right. He's still there.
It's amazing. Well, that's pretty impressive loyalty in that sense. But like that, I mean, yes, there were some missteps with Scientology and marriages and stuff. But in terms of movie careers that last, in terms of the level that he was at, almost unheard of to have. You know, I wonder how much all the money that his movies have grossed. I'm trying to think if is there anybody even close. Like, is DiCaprio close? I don't even know.
Harrison Ford might be up there.
Oh, there you go. That's an amazing career. Did he do stuff before? I'm trying to think. He did American Graffiti.
Right.
But that was a very small role.
He was in there for a while.
Was Han Solo his first big starring role, or do you know?
American Graffiti was a pretty big movie.
But he didn't, that's so long ago. Did he lead, was he the lead in that?
No, Ron Howard was the lead.
Richard Dreyfuss,
but he was, listen, you know, he had a couple races in that car, and you know.
Why isn't Richard Dreyfuss starring stuff? Jaws, this guy's incredible. Goodbye Girl? He just sort of went away, right?
It's hard.
They don't, Hollywood, it's a weird thing, man. Getting older in Hollywood is rough.
Particularly for females.
At least in our profession, if you're writing, in theory, you can still write until whenever, as long as you got a good agent. If you have Jim Miller's agent, you could probably write until you're 90. All right, Lou Pellegrino, is there anything you want to ask Jim Miller before I let him go? I'll put you on the mic here if you want. I know you're a big entertainment fan.
I'm okay. I'm just riveted by listening to this.
You're doing crossword puzzles over there.
No, I was actually looking up some of the things that he was talking about because in my head, I'm thinking Tim Meadows, I think, was 10 years and then Hammond passed.
Oh, that's good.
Was Tim Meadows longer than Daryl?
No, Tim Meadows was the longest and then Daryl Hammond passed him.
That's good stuff.
Is he still considered a cast member now? I mean, I know he comes back and he does the voiceover, right? I think he took over.
And he was doing Trump before Alec.
Right. Because he took over for Pardo after Pardo passed.
That's right.
Tim was another talented guy. All right, listen, let's go through all of Jim Miller's work before we...
Oh, my God, please.
Just to give him some publicity.
All right, we got to go.
We have CAA. The CAA book is called Powerhouse. It's Powerhouse colon something? What is it? What's the exact title?
The Untold Story of Creative Artist Agent, Hollywood's Creative
Okay,
Artist
that's Agent. Available in bookstores now, online. That's sold very, very well. Are you doing any more speaking for that? Because I went to the one thing that you did thank you for the invite, by the way, with Ron Meyer. That was fascinating. That whole world is fascinating to me. Are you still doing the book tour now, or is it pretty much one that
you know, like at festivals or speeches or something like that?
All right, so check that out. Like, Jim Miller wrote the ESPN oral history. These guys have all the fun. It's something like Inside the World of
ESPN.
Of Jamie Horowitz, Inside the World of ESPN.
I didn't even interview Jamie Horowitz for the ESPN book.
I'm surprised about that. You have the Live from New York book, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which never goes out of style. With the update, I would buy that actually. If you're a big Saturday Night Live fan, you should absolutely.
That
own
was
that.
Fun. Went back and updated for the 40th.
That's one you have to have. And I think you actually did a book on the Senate once. We didn't even get to that, right? What was that called?
Running in Place.
Those are the four.
Mm-hmm.
You have a really good track record of. The books that you do have really been successful.
Thank you.
Was the first book successful? The Senate one?
Yeah.
Fairly one, right? You're almost hitting 1,000 as an author.
Well,
I'm just, listen, all your magazine pieces aren't hitting 1,000, but the books, though. The books.
Excuse me.
The books, though. 4 for 4.
Wow.
Jeez, very impressive.
Magazine pieces now. He's taking them.
No, they're good, but I'm saying you know, go 4-for-4 in books is the important thing. All right, Jim, is there anything else? Do you want to promote anything else? I have nothing else left in this podcast.
No, but thank you for having me.
You're welcome. How many people you think in the ESPN PR department will listen to this podcast from the beginning of the podcast to where we're talking now? It's probably a department in Bristol of about 15 and then globally 50 or something like that. How many? I'm going to say 85% of – no, take it back. I'm going to say 70% of ESPN PR people will listen to this beginning to end.
I would assume that I listen to all your stuff. I don't think the fact that I'm on makes a difference to that.
All right, Jim Miller. I'm bored of myself at this point. Jim Miller has been the guest.
Unbelievable.
He is fantastic, and we all know that. I mean, the guy's success speaks for itself. Actually, Jim is a very good guy, and all bullshit aside, he's a great guy to know. He's been incredibly generous to me and super talented. I recommend, including his magazine work, anything he does. Previous podcast guests, Erica Nardini, the Barstool Sports CEO. She was really interesting. That was a great conversation. Lauren Duca, the Teen Vogue Weekend editor who wrote the piece Donald Trump is Gaslighting America that blew up and well over a million page views now. We thank her for being a guest. Joe Tessitore, before those two, the fine ESPN broadcaster. I'm not sure we will have a podcast before 2017. So thank you very much for listening this year. The numbers have been far better than we ever expected for a sports media podcast. I mean, talk about niche, but thanks for finding us, and we'll bring you some more good stuff in 2017. Let me thank the guys at Digital Media, particularly Lou Pellegrino, who's been producing this podcast for the last couple months at Sports Illustrated, Ryan Hunt, Chris Stone, John Wertheim, and Ben Eagle. This is Richard Deitch. Have a great new year. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.